Hi, I'm Fred Schonenberg, and thank you for joining me on the Venture Fuel podcast. At Venture Fuel, we help companies find new solutions by partnering with the best startups from around the world. On the show, you'll learn the secrets of business leaders who tap into startups and the founders driving extraordinary results. We'll consider new ideas, stretch our mindsets beyond the status quo, and in the process, discover how to leap the competition and fuel personal growth. On today's show, we have Kristen Cavallo, who is the CEO of the Martin Agency. Kristen was on the very first panel of our very first Rogue Women event, and I've been dying to get her on the podcast. She is part cool swashbuckling mom and part visionary thought leader, creating impactful ideas for clients like Geico, Oreo, UPS, CarMax, Old Navy, DoorDash, and Axe. And she is on a mission to fight invisibility with breakthrough work and an inclusive culture. She's helped to eradicate the wage gap by race and gender, leveled the playing field for women in leadership, and tied diversity to business goals. Today, we're going to talk about the lessons she has learned as she continues to lead her agency and, quite frankly, the industry overall into a better future. So let's get after it. Kristen, how the heck are you? It's been too long.
I'm really stressed after that intro. Like, I was like, I better get to work. I'm good, though. I'm good.
Well, you more than live up to it. So no need to stress. I mean, I often talk about, you know, how Rogue Women came to be. And, you know, it was, in theory, it was just going to be a little lunch. And then all of a sudden, there was a lot of interest. And then we decided to get some space. And it became this event. And that first panel was you and Mel Strong, who was at Nike at the time. And you all just like, you stripped away all the BS, the amount of knowledge that was shared. I get goosebumps thinking about the electricity in that room. And it sort of just, it launched what Rogue Women has become. And it kind of felt like a, you know, the top of a carbonated beverage being twisted off. Could you feel that up on stage that day?
I could. You know, it was one of those weird moments where, and I'd never met Mel before that day. And as this has happened a couple times in my life where I meet someone on a panel that you feel like there's a great sense of energy and shared value system. And we've kept in touch ever since then. That's how I met Karen Costello, my first chief creative officer partner at Martin. We also met on a panel 4 or 5 years prior to our working together. And I thought, wow, gosh, if we were ever on the same time zone, she'd be the kind of person that I would love to work with. And then we ended up not only being in the same time zone, but at the same agency. And so it worked really well. I do remember you guys had created a really cool environment where it felt like it was intimate and that we could be really honest, which I think has the benefit of a lot of good panels, is when you feel like you can be really transparent and candid. But I had, you know, so we really did let it rip, so to speak. Mel in particular, but, and then there were reporters in the room, so then that ended up being captured later. And so I do think it made it, we were both a little tense coming out after that, not in the moment, but afterward, but we had the truth on our side. And so while the world that we lived in was a little bit uncomfortable with the transparency that we'd shared, the truth is they should have been more uncomfortable with the reality, not with the fact that we shared it.
Well, it was so
right, but I think as often that happens, right? Where the reality has become, it becomes the normal course of business. So you get numb to it, like the frog in the boiling pot of water, right? And so when you get called out or held accountable, people get tense. But the truth is, the truth should make them tense, not the accountability.
Absolutely. It was crazy. I mean, you guys really did just set the tone. And ever since then, every event we've had, or even the panels that day, have kind of shared that raw honesty. And it is extremely rare. And I think that's why it continues to exist. So we owe you and Mel a gratitude for setting that tone. But I've also enjoyed it because since then, of course, you and I linked in, and I've just been following all like the amazing things you and the Martin Agency have been doing. Can you share just some of the recent accolades, just to level set, in case anyone does not know who you and the Martin Agency are?
Yes, well, we're back-to-back Agency of the Year for Adweek, which is a rare occurrence. It's only happened a handful of times, to my knowledge, in the industry. And, you know, Campaign has recognized us, Ad Age has recognized us. I think at the beginning, for a lot of the efforts and ambition we had regarding D&I, DEI, and B, depending on how you want to talk about it. And now, most recently, for the work that has come because of that and the broader aperture, the broader storytelling that we've been able to achieve because we rebuilt the way the company is staffed and works. And so, yeah, it's been, you know, I don't want to take credit for the work of 400 some really hardworking people and some amazing clients that give us really wonderful briefs and assignments and trust our judgment and where we really have strong collaborative relationships. So I would say it is the work of a lot of people, but it is, you know, from where we were to where we are now is a remarkable, remarkable story in and of itself.
Well, one of the things I wanted to touch on with Rogue Women 5 coming up on March 24th for us, the theme...
Like Fast and Furious.
Oh my gosh, it comes so fast.
Rogue Women 5 feels like a franchise.
You know what? Like we were joking. It was like, it feels like a Rocky poster, like a Jaws movie.
Like, exactly.
We're looking back at like our Latin to figure out which Roman numeral to put in. But the theme this year is financial empowerment for women. And I know that you and the team have done so much to eradicate sort of wage gap by race and gender. Can you just talk a little bit about that as a, you know, an area that you focused and some of the things you've done?
Sure. You know, it's really important. It continues to be important. We continue as a society to talk about it every year. There are years where there is improvement. There are more years where there's no improvement. And I think it's something that's a sad thing we've learned to live with. And I want to hopefully correct that and not learn to live with it. So it was really one of the first acts when Karen and I took over the agency was to eliminate the wage gap. And I think that one of the reasons, while we had not been preparing for these jobs, you know, we found ourselves in these jobs quite suddenly, it felt like the right first act because we ourselves have gone through our entire careers wondering or believing we weren't paid fairly. And so while the majority of people in the agency were fairly paid, and we did not statistically have a wage disparity by gender, there were a handful of people. But the gift that was given that day to everybody was the knowledge that they were fairly paid, whether they got the increase in pay or whether they didn't get the increase in pay. Because I would tell you that before that day, 99% of women believed that they were unfairly paid because we hear every year that women make 83 cents on the dollar, 63 cents if you're a woman of color. And so the assumption your whole career is that you're behind. And then when you're juggling the hard choices between parenting and work, and they're being presented to you as black and white choices. And so you don't always think, how do I negotiate my way through this? How can I do both? How can I lean into one without having a setback in the other? And unless you're free to have those negotiations and those transparent conversations, the assumption is that you have to leave while you raise a child or children. I'm a single mother of two. So there's this belief then that there's going to be a gap. And that gap at the beginning might seem small, but by the time you hit retirement, the gap that you took in your 20s or 30s by not getting promoted or taking some period of time, even if it was just your allowable maternity leave, you know, women start at the same pay scale as men at the beginning of their careers, but after their childbearing years, they're not by middle management because they took this time out, so to speak, and therefore they didn't get the promotion, they didn't get the raise, they didn't get the opportunity. And by the time you extrapolate that out to retirement, the gap in retirement is 30%. Women have 30% less money at retirement than their male peers. And we live 5 years longer. So you have to course correct at the beginning of your career. I could talk about this all day long.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's my family went through something very similar recently. So this is very top of mind for us. So I have like a million personal questions that probably aren't what this podcast should be about, but maybe at like a high level, can you talk about how do you go about leveling the playing field for women in leadership or trying to help right this like clear wrong that seems almost systemic at this point?
Well, a number of things. One, when I'm talking to young women, I often encourage them not to feel like they have to make a full choice one way or the other, though that is absolutely a choice. And I don't fault anyone for that choice. I will fight as hard for you to take maternity leave or take a year off as I will for you to come back after your maternity leave. No matter what, you should take your maternity leave. And I think you should be paid well during that time. But I also will counsel people who are on the other side of that when it comes to promotions, not to unconsciously bias against someone who wasn't here, meaning that they can't handle the promotion. Hmm. We often, I think men do a better job. Let me phrase it more positively. Men do a better job throwing their hat in a ring for a job they might not be qualified for than women do. Women feel a greater sense, I think, of imposter syndrome at some points in their career. Men feel a stronger bullishness on their own ability. And I don't, you know, I don't mean that as a negative. I think that women need to see that they can rise to the occasion and that in fact, maybe some of the same skills that enable them to be good at being a mother or a parent are also good at making them good at work, right? So when there are kind of unconscious moments where I might look at a list of people who are being considered for promotion, if I don't see a very representative list, if I don't see mothers on that list, if I don't see part-time workers on that list, if I don't see, I'll look for what I don't see and I will make sure that there is great visibility put into that. I will strongly encourage women to throw their hat in the ring, to raise their hand, to go for something. We will give them ample support in every way, shape, or form around them so that they can achieve. Everyone needs to know that when you get an opportunity at work, I'm not wishing for you to fail. Your failure is my failure, right? So my hope is that they all feel like the responsibility is not shouldered by them alone, but that they have 400 some people and an executive leadership team as an army behind them, ready to move mountains if they need to make them succeed. So I hope that the women feel emboldened and then we pay them very fairly.
Yeah.
By race and gender. It has to be a conscious choice and it helps people feel invested in and feel supported.
So let me ask you that as a CEO, you know, you're trying to invest in your people. That's your product at the end of the day, right? And especially in a creative space at the same time, right? You're running the P&L. And so how do you make sure that playing field is level and sort of build that in? I mean, one of the things I love that you talked about in one of the bios I read on you was that, you know, you tie diversity to business goals. So maybe you could talk about some of the like actual specifics to how this happens.
Absolutely. I think there are a number of things. There's no one silver bullet.
Yeah.
First, I believe there's a direct correlation between internal success and external success. So I don't view investing in my people as a cost. In the same way that I don't view the growth on the other end as just a benefit. I think that the more I invest in my people, the more I'm going to grow. And so to me, I don't think about it as I'm not going to cost cut my way to success.
Right.
I know that you can, in the short term, control your margin by reducing your cost. But really, the only shield is growth. That is the only shield you have. And the way to grow is by investing in your people. One of the reasons that we changed up our leadership team so quickly, that was, you know, if the wage gap was the first thing, that 1B was changing the leadership team.
Right.
Two, we doubled the number of women, added people of color, because every study I'd ever read, and I'm a stats major, I'm a Nancy Drew fan from young, you know, my little wee life. And so I will interrogate research because I think numbers can be misconstrued. But every which way I'd seen the research, every piece of research had said that if you invest in a diverse leadership team, you'll have higher margin, higher return, higher morale, higher everything. And so of all the things that I had at my disposal, that was a controllable one. So I'm sitting here thinking to myself, I don't actually know how any publicly held company's leadership doesn't have a diverse leadership team. If you don't, then you have two things to explain. One, why aren't you making the table bigger? And two, why aren't you taking yourself or others out of the way? Because you have an obligation to grow your bottom line. This is a controllable way to grow your bottom line. it is, I can bank on it statistically more than I can bank on new business or finding the right client. Or, you know, I mean, I could develop a wonderful ad campaign for UPS, but if the price of oil goes up and their costs go up, I don't know that it's going to have the impact I need it to have. That's outside of my control. But by diverse leadership team and a team that feels invested in from a culture perspective is within my control. And so I believe that there is that direct correlation. And I believe not enough CEOs, to be honest, are held accountable to why they're not. A lot of people talk about diversity, but not a lot of people are really held accountable as to why they don't. I think when I hear, to be honest, these stats that say, I think for venture capitalists, they'll say, I have to have one woman on my board by whatever, 2025. I mean, one woman on a board is not statistically significant enough to make a difference. That is a token. That is the definition of tokenism. And you're, again, your responsibility is to the bottom line. So I don't think you should get away with that. I don't think anyone should. I think the board of all these companies should be looking at the CEOs and saying, why are you not doing this? And a token is not enough. It is not only morally correct, it is the best business decision you can make.
I know I've seen some of these stats very much in the VC world, you know, looking at female-founded companies, diverse-founded companies and their performance. And I mean, it's unbelievable. The more likelihood to succeed, the better returns for investors. And you see these numbers and you go, wait a second. Like, venture capitalists are supposed to be the ones looking for competitive advantage, seeing if there's, you know, how they can spot the next unicorn or this or that. And it's like, this is the clearest evidence in the world. And yet—
Exactly right. What are the odds? Yeah. I mean, you know the venture capital world. What are the odds? Is it 8 out of 10 fail? Is it 6 out of 10? What if you knew that 95% of the time, by developing a diverse leadership team, you would have higher returns? There is a statistical correlation between revenue uplift and investment in diversity. And it is 100% in the control of the CEO. It is just plain stupid not to do it. And I think more CEOs need to be held accountable for why they're not doing it and why they're not doing it fast enough. And really, at the end of the day, it comes down to they don't want to remove themselves.
Yeah. I mean, that's, I remember reading something when I was probably like 28 and I read some leadership book and it said, you should always be searching for and grooming your replacement, right? That you always want to kind of have smarter people than you around you so that, you know, it continues to push you farther in your life and career. And as I've gotten older and looked around, it doesn't seem that everyone else read that book. you know what I mean? It kind of seems like they insulate themselves. And maybe that's a reverse imposter syndrome. I know you and I were talking about imposter syndrome before. And maybe it's that, you know, they don't want to be found out that maybe the emperor has no clothes. But it just, the math seems
to... The fastest way of getting found out, though, is failure.
Yeah.
It's like you've only just made it harder to push the rock up the hill. Like, just make more seats at the table. Make the table bigger. It's a fallacy to believe that the pie can't be bigger. That, you know, like, create roles.
Yeah.
I think if you had to choose between creating a role and diluting your voice or keeping a voice and statistically failing, which is ultimately going to dilute your voice much more firmly and you know, forever, then you would dilute your voice.
Yeah.
I don't know. I have a weird thing. And maybe it comes from the fact that I'm an army brat. So I don't really imagine myself staying anywhere forever. And so I view that my job as a CEO is to, over time, become invisible and unnecessary. And so I feel like I need to be looking always to the next thing and raising up people to take over this company as if they would one day lead it.
I love it. Well, so let me zone in on the next thing comment. So, I mean, I think we actually first met years ago when you were at Mullen Lowe, and I did like an emerging tech day and kind of came in and showed some new ad tech and whatnot.
I remember.
Okay. I wrote in the notes, I was like, I think that's where we met. It feels like it was yesterday, but also a long time ago. So from your standpoint, what role does innovation and new technology play when you're thinking about delivering new ideas for your clients?
Yeah, you know, it is such the question that as an industry, we love to debate and talk about and then beat ourselves up for. And it often comes down to this, again, false choice between data and creativity, that people feel like they have to choose one versus the other. Again, maybe being a stats major, I feel like I see that we have data everywhere. We have access to every metric and data set imaginable. And yet we still make forgettable ads. 84% of all ads are invisible and forgettable. And so if the data alone meant that we were going to have better breakthrough or more talked about work, then I would subscribe all to the data all day long. But the truth is we have tons of data and we don't have greater breakthrough and we don't have people talking about the work. The truth is research tells us where we are and what we do, but 53% of people say they make impulsive decisions and half of the people who RSVP to something don't show up. So if data was there to predict our behavior, then I would say it's questionable. I think the real money being made on data is that people are selling the data for retargeting purposes. It's not that the data is being used to have higher breakthrough or higher talkability. And relevance is statistically the most accurate predictor of sales success, is how relevant you are as a brand. So if the point of all communications then is to drive relevance, relevance is measured in conversation. A 10% lift in conversation equals a 3% lift in sales. So to me, every brief that every client should give should be, how do I get more talked about? How do I become a better part of conversation? How do I become a more relevant brand? And the truth is, just because you sell insurance doesn't mean that you have a YouTube channel boasting more subscribers than entire networks like Geico. What gets me excited is, how do I earn consumers' attention through insight or surprise or entertainment? And COVID has actually only made us crave entertainment more. I think I read something last week where we absorb 30% more content today than we did before COVID. Really? And when you look at the big deals being made, I heard Bob Iger speak the other day, and I was reading something about a lot of the mega $1 million, $1 billion deals. You're talking about Discovery and AT&T. You're talking about Amazon buying MGM. You're talking about Blackstone buying Hello Sunshine, CAA acquiring ICM, the South Korean CJ Entertainment, the ones that bought Parasite, buying Endeavor content for, you know, billions and billions of dollars, millions of dollars being done. What that tells me is that there is an active, growing, deep business in the production of content. But not all content is equal. All movies aren't equal. All TV shows aren't equal. All ads aren't equal. And at the end of the day, it comes down to talent. If it was just about data, all things would be equal. We would be able just to buy the data and do it. And I think that, A, it's a false question. You need to probably have both. But I think that this question of data over entertainment or talent is a mistake.
Yeah, I agree. I think if you can put the two together, and if technology or, you know, emerging startups can provide ways to accelerate that relevancy, but they have to work together, right? Creativity is the key. I mean, I'm going to put you on the spot and ask you to share a favorite ad or two, which I know is like choosing from your children. But I mean, I will say last night I was watching the NCAA tournament basketball selection show. There was a Geico ad that was basically two guys in the Wild West facing off. And right, you know, they're going to shoot off at high noon.
3 o'clock. Yeah.
Oh my God. And then they pull out their like calendar and they're like discussing the times. That doesn't work for me. I'm getting my hair cut. And like, it made me laugh out loud. I went upstairs and told my wife about an ad, which, like, you know, I just saw 70 ads during this show, right? The whole show was created to drive advertising revenue for the most part. And there was only one that stuck. And I know that's one of your clients. So that wasn't the reason it stuck, but do you have any examples of work that you're in? Obviously, you're incredibly proud of a lot of what you do, but that you would share with the audience that kind of brings to light this idea of creativity, or maybe ties back into the purpose that we were talking about before?
Well, certainly Geico. I mean, again, going back, they're the brand that has the YouTube channel that has more subscribers than entire networks, not just shows, entire networks. People are choosing to go on YouTube to watch Geico ads because they are a source of joy and entertainment. I would say it's hard for me to take any kind of credit for those, but I did have a role in making the ice cream. So we had a TV spot about ice cream, the scoop, there it is. But actually then making the ice cream was something that I was passionately all for and kind of helped nudge, annoy, provoke that into some kind of life, because I'm a huge ice cream fan, but also just made an enormous amount of sense. And they ended up having like a billion impressions in 24 or 48 hours. But I also think it brought a lot of joy, right? To people. You know, this is a funny piece of research. More consumers can cite the words, the lyrics to the Scoop, There It Is ad than the national anthem in the United States.
Oh my gosh. I don't know if that's a positive stat, but that is amazing.
I know. It is crazy. Other ads I've loved. Yeah, we did an ad when I was at Mullen for American Greetings called World's Toughest Job. And it was for Mother's Day, which Mother's Day is a made up holiday by greeting card companies, some say, or flower companies or candy companies. But I would say as a mother, I'm happy for it, you know, but it's really a sad day too. Something, I don't remember the exact statistics, but a really high, embarrassingly high number of people give cards and forget to sign them or don't give a card at all. Like it's really kind of sad, but we did an ad for the World's Toughest Job, which is a mother. We developed a company of mother spelt backwards. We did online interviews, which was before Zoom was all the rage. We told people that there would be this job, that it had no pay, that it was 24 hours a day, that the workload went up on holidays and weekends, that you couldn't eat until your associate had already eaten their meal first, that sometimes you had to make them more than one meal, that you had to be good at, you know, cooking and finances and medical and entertainment. And people were just like, no, I would not take this job. There were no raises, there were no bonuses other than an occasional hug and someone telling you did a good job. And at the end, we revealed that it was for mothers. And every year, so the ad itself never ran on TV, it ran online. And, but mothers ended up becoming the primary media channel. Mothers sent it to other mothers. And in the year that it was introduced, it was the most watched video in the world during that quarter. And every year it organically comes back during Mother's Day and mothers send it to other mothers. And it's just this gift of an idea. That client ended up leaving and going to Terminix, and he's my client now at Terminix. And so that has been a gift in and of itself. But that one, it was a faux company for a faux job for a faux holiday, but very real emotions and very real heart and very real insight that and leading to the grand Effie of that year as well, which was pretty remarkable.
Wow. That is super cool. Well, Kristen, I'll get you out of here on this. Is there anything else that I didn't ask you about, either that you're excited about or that you wanted to share about, and any piece of what we talked about?
I'm always excited to talk to you.
It's fun.
I would say I hope that for the women or the bosses watching, that we really invest in each other and continue to find ways to talk about new ways to do things. Because I think that the business world needs women, whether it's this industry or any industry. And I'm also a mother, and I value that job heavily. I value my job in advertising heavily. And I feel like women can do both and should be rewarded fairly for doing both. And I think we need more people walking into conversations from that perspective so that women don't feel like they are at a loss before they ever get to the table. So that would be my hope. And if not, and if you feel that loss, then come work for me.
I love it. Where can people go to learn more about you or the Martin Agency?
Well, find me on LinkedIn, our website, martinagency.com. But LinkedIn is where we do a lot of our work.
Perfect.
In terms of reach out and, you know, hiring. Yeah, thank you. Awesome.
Thank you so much for all you do.
And good luck on Fast and Furious 5.
Fast and Furious 5, yeah. We'll get you back on for the 8th one or something like that.
Awesome. Only if Mel comes too.
All right, that's a deal. Thanks so much for joining us today. I hope you had as much fun as I did talking with Kristen. March 24th, 12 p.m. to to 2 p.m. Eastern time is our Rogue Women 5 event that we spoke about in this interview. It's going to be an unbelievable lineup of amazing female executives, female founders, and female investors getting together to talk about very similar conversations to what we had with Kristen today. If you go to LinkedIn and look up at Venture Fuel, you'll see all the information to register. I would love to have you there. It's free for everyone to enjoy. And we'll also post some of those conversations in the future on the podcast. But to watch it all live and be able to engage with all the guests, speakers that will be there, please join us March 24th, 12 to 2 p.m. Eastern time. Just go to Venture Fuel at LinkedIn. Looking forward to seeing you there. Take care.